I'm Nick Zeppos, Chancellor of Vanderbilt University. Welcome to the Zeppos Report, a podcast where I talk with the people shaping and helping us understand our world. My guest today is Susanna Herculano-Hussell, Associate Professor of Psychology and Biological Sciences at Vanderbilt. Susanna joined our faculty in 2016 after spending the bulk of her academic career in her hometown of Rio de Janeiro. Her groundbreaking work in neuroanatomy and refined ability to communicate this science is absolutely remarkable. In 2013, she became the first Brazilian to present a TED Global Talk. This video has now garnered more than 2.5 million views. Susanna has joined me in my office to teach us, to enlighten us on the fascinating work found in her book that was published last year, The Human Advantage, A New Understanding of How Our Brain Became Remarkable. Susanna, welcome to the Zeppos Report.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Well, I have to start out by kind of telling you, I remember when we were recruiting you, and I think you had probably crossed paths, given how important your work is with Isabel Gautier and Ken Catania and John Koss and so many phenomenal people at Vanderbilt. But I was really introduced to you because I, with great passion, read the New York Review of Books, and I get so much pride when I see a Vanderbilt faculty member reviewed or mentioned. And I was opening it up, and it was the review of your book with your picture.
Yes.
And I in a lab, and I thought, wow, this is really important.
And it was a good review, which made me so happy.
It was a fabulous review. But we also say there's nothing worse than having your work ignored. But it was really featured widely in many, many outlets. First of all, let's start a little bit with how your journey to this place of distinguished neuroscientist, neuroanatomist came about. Your parents are academics?
Yeah,
your mother's a sociologist and your father's an economist?
Economist, yeah.
You said but. So obviously you're not.
I was the first one to bring a single book on anything living, anything biological to that household.
Are you saying they were in the dry disciplines?
No, they're in the humanities.
Humanities, yeah.
Yeah. They're huge. I couldn't say science buffs, I guess, although they in a way they very much are. But it's just that the type of knowledge that they're interested in is completely different from what I became interested in.
But did you grow up in a household where ideas and learning?
Oh my God! Yes.
I mean, was it just part of the
and reading was common, was second nature. I don't even keep track anymore of what I've read and when I've read it because it's just I can't keep up with it. But yeah, I grew up in a house where we had my parents' library was at least 2,000 books, and they were always looking for new things to read, both fiction and nonfiction, and they were always discussing vividly what they were reading. So I think what jumps to mind the most is that I grew up in an atmosphere where criticism was highly encouraged, and especially if it was informed criticism.
Right, I was going to say informed criticism.
Informed
around
criticism.
The dinner table.
Yeah, that was wonderful. So my, I think sometimes my dad has said that to me and my sister. I wonder what I did that I turned the two of you into such rebels.
because inside every great scientist, there has to be, or a great thinker, there has to be bit of the rebel, because it's like, why is it this way?
I think
no one has explained it, or it's wrong.
I think it's the essence of scientific investigation, and that's what sets it apart from just, you know, living by accepting whatever people tell you, which leads to superstitions and just fables. But it's really just asking yourself, just taking a step back to ask yourself, how do we know this? Do we really know this, or do we think we know this? Yeah. So why are you saying this? And so, yeah, even though they are not exactly scientists, I guess, the...
Well, we'll say they're social scientists.
They're social scientists, yeah. We grew up with this sense that what you do in life is inform yourself, look for information, ask questions, and just don't accept things at face value. Just ask, why are you telling me this?
Yeah. What did, looking back, do you remember a particular moment when you said, I'm interested in how the brain works? You now kind of, I think, affectionately and with a jocular sense, perhaps refer to brain soup. How did you get interested in the brain and animals?
I graduated from college without even realizing that we had a brain. I first came to the U.S. in 92 to start graduate school, thinking that I was going to get a degree in genetics. In developmental genetics. So the cool thing back then was molecular genetics and investigating.
And that was at Case Western?
That was at Case Western in Cleveland.
Yeah.
The
molecular genetics.
Yes. And I'm I joined the program thinking, well, I know what I want to do. And then I was told, you have to take three rotations at least. And I'm thinking, oh, that's just a waste of time. Just I know what I want to do. Just let me do what I want to do already. And so I took the first two rotations in molecular genetics, Drosophila labs that did very much similar things. But then I made friends with somebody who had previously worked as a research assistant in a neuroscience lab. And he was absolutely infatuated with neuroscience, and he asked me if he could try to convert me. So we would walk around, and this was Ken Tovar. We would walk around, and he would just keep throwing problems at me and saying, "See, there's a tree behind me. How do I know that there's a tree behind me? I can't even touch it. See, yeah. It's right here, but I can see it. How can I possibly know there's a tree still there?" And it wow. just I started realizing that there was this entire world out there that didn't stop at the doorstep of the lab, whereas the things that I was doing, and this is not at all to demean the people who think that molecular genetics is the coolest thing ever. Sure. Again, I think diversity is the most interesting thing.
It's
so great
here.
That a number of people don't think what I do is the coolest thing ever. But to me, I started looking at those little tubes of invisible molecules and thinking, I don't even know what's in here. I have to believe that the tests that I do to tell me what it is here. And do I really want to study this little part of this little chromosome of this little of this animal that's expressed during only this period of time and become an expert in just that little thing? Or do I want to try something different and maybe give it a shot? And so I went for a third rotation in a neuroscience lab with Story Landis, and wow. I never looked back because wow. it was just one new interesting question after the other. The topics are never ending because that's what we do. It's life, and your understanding your brain is pretty much you can think of any single thing you do in your day in terms of how could I possibly do this.
Do you think of yourself as a philosopher at times because of the questions you ask and what philosophers will say in response to you?
I think that's an interesting way to look at it. I think many of the scientists that we have today, back in the day, you would call them philosophers.
Natural philosophy yeah.
turned into, we just give it a different yeah. name. We don't call it natural philosophy anymore. It's just that I think that different people, depending on their interests and what exactly they do, so what tools they use, what kinds of questions they're used to looking at during their day, will have more or less of, let's say, a philosophical approach to what they're doing. I know that I am I'm not interested in the the details. Mm-hmm. As soon as something starts getting too detailed, I'm like, somebody else can figure this out. Somebody else knows, has the molecular tool. Somebody else has everything that they need to do this much better than I could. Yeah. I want to go that way. There's another big question over there, which also has a lot to do, again, constraints. We're talking constraints. I was working in Brazil. There was no possible way I could compete with people in the U.S., in Europe, in Australia, who were doing molecular biology and cellular biology with much more money, much more
instrumentation,
access to knowledge, access to other experts.
Yeah, networks of people.
It was an accident of circumstances that I became interested in what I realized were these really basic questions about neuroscience. What are different brains made of, and what does that matter? How does the human brain compare to any other brain, big or small? And those were questions that I realized everybody thought that everybody else had already figured that out, and they had just moved on to the cool high tech details.
Right.
And I started looking at the original literature, and I'm like, we don't know any of this. There's a bunch of intuitions here, but we don't really have the data to tell one way or the other. So, and I think I know a way to do this, and I think it's not even going to require a lot of money, because I didn't even have a lab at the time.
Wow.
And I think I'm going to turn brains into soup. So I was lucky to find somebody who thought that the idea was not entirely preposterous. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
what about, you spent so much time on brain evolution and looking across species mm-hmm. and through time. And I think you've said that the human brain is remarkable, but it's really not unique and just of a whole different character it's not special.
It's not special.
It's remarkable, but it's not special.
Yes.
And those seem to me the same thing, but yet...
Oh, I work really hard
on that.
To breaths and use the right word.
Yeah.
So, extraordinary means literally out of the ordinary, mm-hmm. so different from what you would expect. Special, to me, is another way of saying that. It's special. The rules don't apply, right? The regular mm-hmm. rules don't apply. Well, but it turns out, that's one of the things that we figured out, that at least in terms of how many neurons and how many other cells the human brain is made of and how those cells are distributed, how much white matter, how much gray matter, and it turns out even how long it takes to develop, how long we live, that's a whole other news story coming up. It turns out that we're just one more point on the curve. But you only realize that once you take an interest in diversity, and more than that, you care to use very simple math to just to understand how things scale, meaning how do brains change as their size changes, right? So once you study enough animals and enough primates and you start understanding those relationships, that's when you realize that the human brain is just one more dot right there on the curve, right there on the line where you would expect. So absolutely ordinary in that sense, right? Not special, not a deviation from the norm. We follow the same rules. But still, all the while, we do have that uniqueness of having the most neurons in the cerebral cortex of any species. We have that because we are primates. So we have just a regular standard primate brain and primate cortex that scaled exactly the way you could have predicted it to. But it so happens that we can afford a number of neurons in a primate brain that no other species can. And that, I believe, that's what the math shows. The only way to get that is if you cheat, let's say, if you bend the rules of the game by putting all those neurons to use, and that's where technology comes in. I love to think of cooking as the very first type of technology.
Going to say, you think that cooking gave humans some big advantage.
So here's the deal. You can do the math on how much energy different brains cost depending on how many neurons they have and how much energy the body that they come in would cost. And you can calculate based on how long it takes different species to eat per day, to eat enough calories per day to afford or to sustain all that. You can calculate what combinations of body size and brain size based on number of neurons would be viable. Now, the thing that we tend to forget because we have beds and we have refrigerators is that you have to be awake in order to eat. Mm-hmm. And if the food is not readily available at your fridge or maybe at the grocery store down the street, you're going to have to go look for it.
Right.
And so once you do all that math, and again, it's still very simple math, you realize that a primate that sleeps as much as we do and that had a brain like we do, we would have to spend 9.5 hours pretty much per day, every single day, looking for food, putting it in the mouth, chewing, until finally you can swallow it. 9.5 hours, yes, to have enough energy. And because we sleep, let's say we're at rest 8 to 9 hours per day, you could not possibly do that. If you look at other primates, the most that they can do, and this is a very hungry orangutan or gorilla, is they'll eat 8.5 hours per day.
Wow.
And they will still lose weight if there's a drought, if it's rainy, if it's just hard. So there's only, what that means is there's only so much food that you can get and ingest, and there's only so many calories that you can get from the food as is. And what the math shows is that if we still did all that, like everybody else does, we're not viable. We could not be here. So what made modern humans possible was whatever trick our ancestors used that allow them to get more calories in less time, right? And cooking does just that. And so my definition of cooking is any type of modification that you do to your food before you put it in your mouth,
right?
So it sounds kind of gross, but it's really what you're doing is pre-digesting your food when you cook it. And heating it up with fire is just one way to do that. But well before that, so 3 million years ago, our ancestors already had the ability, they had already developed the technology of carving their own stone tools. And once you have a stone tool, you pretty much have a knife. Yeah. So you don't depend on your teeth anymore to gnaw through hide, to tear muscle. That's all very, very hard to do.
And energy consuming.
And energy consuming and time consuming. So now that all of a sudden, I mean, imagine you had to fend for yourself. You're left alone in an island. You have zero tools. There's a goat. You have to kill that goat first with your bare hands. You have to then eat that goat with your hands and with your teeth. And it's gonna be pretty hard. But if you figured out by then how to turn something into a cutting instrument, you can get to the muscle. You can chop the muscles down. You can use that with tubers. So all of a sudden, you have, thanks to this first technology, you can pulverize it, you can crush it, you can mesh it. So, and all of that makes it much easier once you put that food in your mouth. It takes less effort to chew it. It takes less time to chew it. And on top of that, once that mashed food gets to your stomach and your intestines, it gets entirely decomposed by enzymes. Mm-hmm. So not only you can ingest more calories per time, you also get more calories out of that food in that little time. And that's the beauty of technology to me. Technology to me is by definition any kind of process, system, object, knowledge, idea that helps you solve a problem. By definition, it buys you more time.
Yeah.
Right? So it buys you more time that you can now use to do something else.
Something else.
Much more interesting than just going around looking for food.
Including making better stones.
Including making better
knives
better knives. So you get
divisions of labor that may be.
So you get this very nice, I think, ascending spiral where as soon as you have enough neurons that give you the biological capability to put things together, to plan ahead, to realize, oh, if I do this, then I end up with a tool. That tool allows you to, in turn, make much better use of all those capabilities that you have. So biology begets technology that gets that biology turned into even fancier, more amazing abilities. And that is where science and education come in. That's education particularly, because we're again too used to this idea that, oh, humans are awesome. The human brain is spectacular. It's different. It does all these cool things. No, it doesn't. We're born with a brain that could do a whole lot, yeah, but only if you teach it to. If you're left to your own devices to figure out how to do things, there's a fair amount that you could do and you will do by yourself. But forget about technology. Forget about building cool houses and universities and doing anything really interesting with your life, because most likely you're going to be spending most of your day just looking for food and hoping that you have enough teeth to eat them.
Yeah, and then you would also say that also allows for the flourishing of, you know, painting on a wall or storytelling.
Absolutely.
That as we say, okay, we have more energy and we get more nutrition and we don't need to eat for 10 hours. We have time to sit and try to tell stories or create an epistemology or a metaphysics.
Right. And going back to talking about different animals, that's when you realize that that's also not particular to humans. Animals love solving problems. That's how you train rats and monkeys and dogs. They love having something to work on, having a problem to solve, right? So what happens the instant that you've taken care of your calories already, you can look around and say, okay, what's next? What can I do?
Yeah.
You start looking for the next problem. And if you already have one, even if rudimentary, piece of technology in your hands, just a stone tool, you can now use it and move ahead and just think of a new problem and use that tool to fabricate a new tool that will help you solve that new problem, which in turn lets you think of yet another problem. And so there's all this know-how. And which is how I like to think now of engineering. You have science, which is this systematic investigation and asking, do we really know this? And so you gain information that way, and you apply that information through technology, and that's what engineering is in essence is to me. That's the application,
of
your discoveries, exactly, and that's. That's why I think bottom line of how come I became so interested in all of this and in science communication as well was to realize that so many people just take that for granted. Mm-hmm. And you ask, well, school, why do I have to go to school? Do I need a college degree? Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
You do, because it's only when you go to school that you expose yourself, that you have a chance to get all that technology, all that know-how and know what transferred onto you. So I've come to think that schools and universities and colleges, any place of transfer of knowledge and transfer of know-how is to be revered. We need that.
Right. I think that when I think of, you know, the colleges and universities and schools, but just at our Vanderbilt, it's we are going to create new knowledge and we are going to then transfer that new knowledge, and then we are going to use all those capabilities and potentials to teach people that, who will then create new knowledge along with us.
And right. The thing is, it takes a little bit of effort of in pointing out to realize that you only get to the part where you can come up with new stuff, new knowledge, if you took the time, if you put in the effort, and if you had the people there to teach you everything that came before you. That's why I've become so interested in doomsday scenario science fiction, because they do this mental, several of them do this mental experiment of asking, how long would it take for everything that we consider to be human life, this is what modern human life is on. How long would it take for all that to be lost? And the answer from these mental experiments, let's say in science fiction, is one generation.
Wow.
All you take is get rid of 90% of people on the planet, and you don't have enough people to hold all the knowledge and all the know-how, right? Wow. So that's you do need a certain number of people. The more knowledge you have, the more people you need to be able to hold that knowledge and to pass it on to the next generation. But more than that, if you don't have enough people to pass that on, you're just not there anymore. Humanity has long transcended what the individual human being can do or think or know.
As you talk about transferring knowledge, you at the same time are, you know, you said, your father said, how did I train these two rebels? You have taken on some dogma and kind of said, I think you might think that, but it's really wrong. What are some of the things that, as you started your career, you said, well, people intuited things. What did people think? What did people intuit that you said, I may be a rebel, but that's maybe good science. I'm going to challenge that. What are the things that you've really challenged?
I started out with the basic intuitive idea that if you take two brains of a similar size, they'll always have similar numbers of neurons. And if you take a bigger brain, it'll always have more neurons than a smaller brain, which is one of the problems when you consider where humans fit in this story, because elephants and so many whales and dolphins have bigger brains than humans do, right? So you would expect them to have more neurons than we do. The standard, again, intuitive answer by then was, well, humans may not have the biggest brain, but we sure have the most brain for the size of our body. We have a much larger brain than you would expect for the size of our body. And it turns out that once you have facts, you realize that it really doesn't matter what the proportion is. As long as you have enough neurons to do the job, let's say, you can get there. So I realized along the way that there were so many, there were all these basic ideas about how neurons are put together and how they vary, that they were all derived from the same basic intuitions that neurons are distributed in the same way, that if you have a bigger cortex, you have more neurons, and that's what makes them fold. Turns out it isn't. Your cortex folds to a certain extent. That is pure physics, regardless of how many neurons you have in it. My favorite current problem right now is you open any textbook and you see that the bigger you are, the longer you live, because the slower your metabolism is. What the data show is a completely different story, that the more neurons you have in your cortex, the longer you live, and you happen to find an incidental correlation with body size and with metabolism, just because those things are correlated with the size of the brain that's built with a certain number of neurons. And thankfully, there's enough diversity that the math can sort all this out.
Are you able to measure, kind of just taking human samples and saying, this person has more neurons than that person? Is the science there for that?
You're talking about living people.
Yeah, is it the imaging? Is it just
not yet
too crude?
Not yet.
Yeah.
No.
Is that Is that an interesting question to you to do?
Absolutely. That's one of the things I'm planning to do here at Vanderbilt. It's to investigate the not just the variation across species anymore, but variation across individual humans. So the usual expectation, the intuition, is that if you have a bigger brain, and men tend on average to have slightly bigger brains than women, you would expect it to have a little bit more neurons. We need to do that experiment in humans, but what we've learned from mice is that no. If you have a bigger brain, there's no guarantee that you have more neurons. There's a huge amount of variation. And is that related to your cognitive capabilities? So how many neurons you have rather than how big your brain is? I like to think, and I kind of hope it's still a no, because so many things in neuroscience have taught us that when it comes to abilities, it's really what you do with your brain.
Right. I think what we don't want to be overly deterministic in saying, well, this is how you're wired. You'll do this, and unfortunately,
right,
Nick will do this. And it's like, well, I'm not taking that for an answer. I think I can do more.
Exactly. And the very fact that the very moment that you think I can do more, you're exposing yourself, you're accepting the idea of exposing yourself to more of buying into bigger challenges. And the more you challenge yourself, guess what? The more you're going to be able to accomplish, right?
So is there any evidence that sort of activity enhances the cortex through life? I know there's a lot of study of brain plasticity and change through time, but
that's learning in essence.
Yeah.
Right. As you try to do something, you start and you take a liking to the problem itself. You expose yourself to it more and more, and what happens is your brain, because it's plastic, it just adapts to it.
It's like reading a foreign language.
You
tennis.
Become good at what you do.
Yeah, that's what I tell students that a lot, and they said, "Oh, you know, I'm really good in this, but I don't know if I like it." And I'm like, "If you're really good in something, don't quite give it up, because you're not going to be good in everything and develop that ability."
Right. So I've started thinking that maybe what really makes a difference between what different people can achieve is just motivation. Or maybe it's a matter of there's one component of how intrinsically motivated you are, and how much people call it now grit, how much grit you have to go after something that interests you. But there's also an aspect there that I think can be learned. You can be encouraged
pursue your interests. Well, I think that's very much what we do on our campus, which is...
And opportunities.
Yeah,
you need to have the opportunities.
You say to a student, you might not have thought of it, but you're really good at X. Why don't you come to my lab? I mean, that's the encouragement and the development of that potential.
I don't mean to make it sound like anybody can do anything.
Sure.
That's where I think it's really important and very handy, let's say, to know your limitations.
No, I mean,
biological limitations do exist.
Yeah.
Right? There's a number of things I know I cannot do. I have learned my lesson. I will no longer try to do them. I rely on people to do those for me, because there are so many people who are so incredibly good at doing that.
What do you make of all of this movement toward artificial intelligence, machine learning? You know, do you kind of see that as, oh yeah, that's what we should expect, because the brain is a computer?
Oh, I mean, how is so much more than a computer.
No, I'm not saying it is.
I know.
I don't buy any of this, but yet, you know, it'll be like, all right, we're going to have autonomous vehicles. We don't need airline pilots. How do you, as a brain scientist, respond to computers will take over the human activities that we know? And I'm a skeptic, so you don't have to.
I think on the one hand, it's very... natural to it's a very reasonable development. That's a very reasonable consequence of everything that we have become able to do so far.
Going to the refrigerator,
right? That's where technology goes. Right. And again, if you go with this idea that technology is whatever helps you solve problems and buy more time to do something else much more interesting, then yeah, I mean, there's. I think one has to remember that we have always had this tendency to demonize technology. Yeah. It just so happens that the state of the art or what comes next right now is artificial intelligence.
Right.
But we have demonized radios and we demonized the internet and television
right.
and elevators
sure.
and
yeah.
take your pick, right? Yeah. So I think AI is just the current demon. On the other hand, I think that's my suspicion is that it is not going to go very far. And because exactly of what is different between a brain and a computer, brains are biological systems. They self-organize. You don't have to put every single part and circuit together from scratch. It self-organizes as it goes through life, as it experiences different things. Computers have to be put together by design, piece by piece, one little thing by one little thing at a time. So you don't have self-organization there. So to me, the way I think about this, for artificial intelligence to actually become just as good as a living brain, it would have to assimilate biology into it. Guess what you have? A natural brain.
No, I tell people, I say, well, all you're going to do is you're going to have the technology to make it biological.
Exactly. Exactly. That's exactly what I like to think.
And if you had a human who said, "I really want to be a computer," you'd be able to give them something to switch back to being human.
Exactly. So I like to think that we are at that amazing point right now where you want to do things that only human brains, self-organized human brains that also come with a body, meaning they have feelings, they have emotions that only they do, ask a person. You want to do something that doesn't require any of that, get out your computer, get out your tablet.
Yeah.
They can already do so much. The best thing is the two of them together.
Yeah. Let me take you kind of back to the journey you were on and, you know, growing up in Rio de Janeiro and doing science in Brazil, and now you're at a university in America. You also trained in Europe and at Case Western. Do you find that neuroscience is a global community of scholars?
Oh, absolutely.
And that you really benefit. I mean, you're here in Nashville, Tennessee, and we're thrilled you're at Vanderbilt, but yet you are from Brazil, and you've trained around the world. Has that been an advantage to you, Susanna, to be such a connected globally?
I think that's one of the things that we get from technology these days, that not only you can learn from so many different people, you can hop on a plane and expose yourself to different people who have different ideas, who look at the same data that you generated in a different way. One of the things that I felt I lacked very much when I was working in Brazil was exactly the ability to just walk down the hall and ask somebody a question. What I was doing there was just so completely different from what everybody else was doing and the questions that everybody else was thinking about that I felt very isolated. And that's one of the many things that I appreciate very much about being here at Vanderbilt. There's such a wonderful, diverse community that I can just tap into and literally just walk down the hall and knock on the door and ask people to think about some things, and that is absolutely amazing. So, yeah, and on top of that, I like to think that also thanks to all this technology that we have now, science these days is a global enterprise. There really are no borders. I got when I received the offer to come here and when everything was in place and I was just literally waiting for a visa on my passport to be able to hop on a plane, I decided it would be a I should do my a good deed, let's say, to the scientific community in Brazil and say, look, you guys are throwing everything away. There's no investment. There's no serious scientific policies for education, for training, for research. I can't do it here anymore. I have this amazing offer to go to an amazing place, do it all there. I'm going to do it. And if I stayed, I wouldn't be able to carry on and do my work. And a number of people just, I had a lot of pushback from colleagues saying, oh, you're just throwing in the towel. Oh, you're just admitting defeat and going to another country. And I'm like, first, if anybody in a regular business, if you're a director of some business and you get an offer to go to another business, nobody's going to question that. Why would you question a scientist's decision to go from one country to another, from one business to another, right? This should be, I think that's another sign of the divide, let's say, between how science actually happens and what people think that science is. There's right. a lot of misinformation there. But second, if it's really about making a contribution, putting my biological tools to work, solving problems, won't I be of much more service if I'm at a place where I can actually do that? So once you realize that science really is international and neuroscientists and cardiologists and developmental biologists, they really work all over the world. I think that's what we have to do now is just make sure that we make good use of all these technologies and airplanes and internet and communication tools yeah. and podcasts.
And bringing people from around the world. I
exactly.
agree with you. You know, whether it's Vanderbilt and then as a matter of national policy, we must invest in basic research and bringing from around the world and keeping in this country the most talented people with the greatest potential to fundamentally alter and improve the way we understand our world, our universe, and ourselves in this world and in nature. And I think that what worries me is, it doesn't worry me, I'm very, very optimistic about Vanderbilt and the direction we're going, and I think there's a lot of support nationally, politically, and locally for investments in science, but we are fortunate that we as a country have made those investments.
Oh, absolutely.
And it brings people from around the world who say, I have these questions I want to ask, and I think if I can make progress, I will leave the world understanding the world better. And that's what we should do, regardless of where it's going to happen.
And that's absolutely amazing. And but the one thing I would add to that is, it's actually, you're talking about making progress, and of course it's easy to think of how positive that is, but I've taken a liking to reminding people of how scary it would be to not even have the opportunities and the schools and the colleges for people to just pass on what they already know, to just keep in place what we already know, so just keep the status quo.
Yeah.
I think it's too easy to think, just like we have, it's too easy to not think about food because we have refrigerators. I think it's become too easy to think that, oh, we don't have to do anything.
Oh,
we don't need to worry about education.
Everybody
will, life will go on as usual. It will go on as it is.
I think the foundation of all that we do, even on the most cutting edge discoveries like you, starts out, and this is kind of when I teach, it's like, okay, what does that mean? What do we know?
Yeah.
And can you tell me what you have learned in interacting with your, peers and me and immersing yourself in what we are exploring? So how do you know what we already know, and how do you know it?
I know.
Why do we know that we can say, okay, there is now a foundation of knowledge that we all have. Now is the time to then say, what about the next thing? But I think one of the most important things that the universities do and the colleges do and all the schools do is we're going to tell you what we know, and we're going to tell you why we know it. We're going to kind of unravel our epistemology.
And that's the part I like the
best. And
is
then
we can
when
teach
we all
you how
know
to
that,
think. Yeah.
Then you know how to think. You've exactly. kind of, and when I teach a lot, I'm a lot of my teaching is I want to know what you think from what you read, so what do I know you know?
Exactly.
And then I can get fancy off that. I can say, what about this? What about that? What about that? But yet I want to know you have immersed yourself in some body of knowledge, and you can articulate to me, this is what it is, and this is how I know it, and this is how I explain it. And I say, okay, now we're ready to go.
And because we keep finding out more and more,
exactly,
it follows that you're going to have to stay at school for a longer and longer period of time.
Longer and longer period of time.
School is no longer enough. You now need college. College is no longer enough. You need a PhD to get to that point of being at the cutting edge, really.
But then I think it's what I've always felt is what brought me into a university is however long I do it, I don't know a lot of things. That there's still so much that I don't know.
Yeah, the more you know, the more you realize you don't know.
And that what we're really doing is educating people to learn what we know, but then to say when you leave, you're going to have to relearn and rethink what you know. And I think that's what really makes for a great mind. Yeah. And that's what really, you know, when you have a graduate student now, or I had law students, it's like, okay, you're going to graduate at this time. This is what we know. In 20 years, you're going to be in the lab. I need to develop in you the skills that say, here's what we know, here's why we know it, and then you're updating that and curious about it. So I think that lifelong curiosity of what do I know and why do I know it is absolutely probably the most important thing we give to our students.
But see, that applies to everybody.
Everybody.
In a college or outside of college,
anywhere.
Let me just say this. I don't think at all that every single person on earth needs a PhD. I don't think that every single person needs to go to college for that matter. It's diversity.
Yeah.
It's whatever works for you. It's whatever suits you, whatever makes you happy, whatever interests you have that you can develop. It's just that as a worldwide population, we do need that diversity. We do need some people who say, I don't care about college. All I want to do is build skyscrapers or I want to put them together. But you also need the other people who know how to do the math and calculate
the material science. And
exactly.
Say, you never thought you could build something that looks like this.
So again,
and
it's
now you can.
So again, it's diversity. That's the beauty to me in diversity.
Agree. Well, let me just say, Susanna, this has been delightful. Thank you for being here today.
My pleasure.
And more importantly, for your vast contributions to the field of neuroscience. You know, my hope and my dream is that you and others will make Vanderbilt the greatest university that really asks and answers these fundamental questions about the brain and brain development and developmental evolution. It's like, who are we? And why are we the way we are? So it's an honor to have you here at Vanderbilt. And you can download this and other episodes of the Zeppos Report at vu.edu/Zeppos-report. vu.edu/Zeppos-report. Thank you, Susanna.
Thank you so much.